All lines are bridged.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the annual report work group of the Health Information Technology Advisory Committee. Thank you for joining us here so early this morning. With us from the work group, we have Carolyn Peterson, one of the co-chairs, and Christina Caraballo. Still waiting for a few other members to join, but we wanted to go ahead and get started, and hopefully they will join us soon. So with that, I will turn it over to Carolyn for a few opening remarks and to review the work group schedule before we dive into the report for fiscal year 19.
Thanks, Lauren. Yes, it's pretty amazing to believe that we're already talking about the report for fiscal year 19 when it seems like we just barely handed off the report for fiscal year 2018. But the good news is that we have some good feedback from members of the HITAC, and so we're in a good place to start thinking about how to structure the upcoming report and what to include in it, with plenty of runway to do whatever research or other work we need to do to ensure another really excellent report. In the past few days, the HITAC has transmitted the fiscal year 18 report to the national coordinator, and that will be moving on to Congress very soon. I see we're joined by Erin Murray and Brett Oliver.
Hello.
Good morning.
Great to see them come this morning to our meeting.
Absolutely. Good morning.
Hey. So I was just welcoming everyone and letting them know that the 18 report has gone, and here we are starting the 19 report.
That's about how it goes. It's great.
That's right. So we have a discussion of potential topics this morning and some planning for our presentation at an upcoming meeting and public comments. And I will pass the mic to Erin for any comments he has.
No, I think it's excellent. It's exciting times. I know that going forward, 19 is going to hit the ground running. I think there's a number of topics I look forward to adding to this report that I think it's important for folks to realize that we deliberately stayed away from because NPRM hadn't been released and others. And so there's been a lot of questions as to will 19 pick up the ball from there. And I think that's a safe assumption. However, things got to get finalized and whatnot, and we got to work through the details. But the 19 report should continue the trajectory that we've started. And it's exciting times. So
yay.
Look forward to it.
Yay.
We do have Christine on the phone here.
All right. Okay. So let's then move on to the discussion points then. So, and looking at some potential topics for the 19 report and thinking about what we want to add on there, items that maybe the members asked for last time that we deliberately paused on. Let's talk about that. And any other items that maybe we've heard in feedback over the past couple of weeks since we finalized the report. Anything, Carolyn, you've heard in your discussions with folks?
Actually, no. I've been really deeply into the CNC work group for the NPRM and also the HITCC.
Mm-hmm.
So, to be honest, I haven't heard a thing about the annual report. I think we're all pretty much in the work group.
That's true. That's
right
very
now.
True. Brett, what about you? Any thoughts of items or things that maybe you heard in passing or items you definitely noted in the back of your mind over the past several weeks that we want to keep on our radar?
Well, as far as the potential topics for consideration that we had already noted, and we've already partially covered the one, but patient matching just continues to be one to get specific that seems to interplay with so many of the other issues. And whether it's brought up saying, hey, work group, annual report work group, you need to be looking at this or not, it seems to be one that we either have to get outside experts to come in and let us know where things live,
mm-hmm.
we need to sort of address it as a HITAC ourselves or some of these other things. It's kind of like a domino at the bottom of the Jenga game.
Right.
And it gets pulled out in the wrong direction. I think we could end up having to redo some work if we don't address it up front.
And I know in the 18 report, we did reference the finalized report that came out of, was it OIG? Or what was 21st Century Cures? They authorized somebody to go after and look and do a report. We referenced it in the, I know we referenced the material.
Yes.
Darn, this is an early meeting, so my mind hasn't woken up yet.
Jeopardy, what agency?
That's right. One of the agencies did a report, and I know we referenced the findings, which basically summarized it to what Brett is saying, is that we need some sort of strategy to deal with it, right? And I think that's a fair topic.
GAO.
GAO, thank you. Jeepers. GAO. So to the degree of it, looking at those and maybe if it's possible to hear from the folks who authored that report and other, I know AHIMA and others have been very vocal on this subject. I know in Texas we have a major issue with identification of patients, particularly as it relates to our indigent care, because one of the criteria from state perspective is being able to accurately identify them to be able to provide them any kind of DSRIP or type of care that we need to. So it's been difficult given that there's such a large population of non-English speaking or other type of status type individuals. So to the degree of it, I think it is something to consider and think about. A topic I've also heard resonate loudly is this out for comment FDA digital paper that was just released about, how do you deal with AI, how do you deal with really bringing this into the healthcare realm, and it does a good job of going into some specific detail about weighing up the risk and is it really patient life affecting or is it more decision support and that sort of thing. And I think it's an excellent authored paper that I do wonder how all the other NPRMs and others will affect that. Because if you think about it, at a very simplistic way, if not all the data flows downstream, how can your algorithms for artificial intelligence or machine learning be accurate, right? So to the degree, the risk that is introduced if there is not a consideration of the downstream effects of say, if the information blocking NPRMs aren't finalized and those components, it's pretty serious. So I think that report, and there's others out there like that floating out there, bring to light the need for truly liberated data, the use of the APIs, and all the other recommendations that we have certified and signed off on. Christina, I know you are in transit. Any comments from you?
I was at a high-tech dinner last night, and I don't know if this fits in the annual report group, but one thing that came up is that we're kind of all going really strong in our task forces right now, and we're coming up with a lot of really great recommendations, but there are some crossover within our recommendations, and it would be really good for us to kind of synthesize across all the task forces and look at what we're kind of all doing in tandem but on our own, and seeing how kind of all the pieces fit together under the larger umbrella. And again, I'm not sure if that lives here. I think it could partially as something that we're looking at, kind of like a connect the dots on everything that's happening and making sure that we're doing that. That could be something that we put in the back of our head or focus on.
Mm-hmm. That's a great point. So kind of looking at the macro picture of all the different Jenga pieces. So now it's going to become our buzzword, Jenga. That's our theme for this year.
Yeah.
No, I love it. That's great. So I think there's
I think that, Aaron, so I think that actually ties into some of the things that we've discussed on our work group so far, which is kind of looking at what the different agencies are doing and how health IT and what we are doing with ONC supports those efforts. So
mm-hmm.
I think it does kind of align with kind of things that we've brought up. Sorry, adding that piece.
That's a great point. That's actually a very good point. You know, the other component that I've seen out there in discussion is how the other HHS agencies are all doing a great job of pulling together to support what's going on with CMS and ONC. Again, I mentioned FDA. I know FTC has some certain actions they've been taking recently to mention items. Social Security Bureau, I mean, all of these different, agencies are doing their part to step up and say, hey, these are the pieces that, the Jenga pieces that we hold, to put together to complete the picture. So I think it's a great point that we can maybe look at the macro landscape and say, where are things? The other item I've heard floated, especially from the healthcare CIO community, is the urgency and the need for true understanding of not only the data being liberated and now flowing, but what is your disaster recovery business continuity plans to make sure the data doesn't turn off in the event of an issue, You know, in a very simplistic way, if you think about from a regional perspective, even if, you know, once the trusted exchange framework is live and you have the data flowing, if in an event of a crisis, you know, if suddenly a section of that were to go down because of an issue, an event, that's a major issue downstream. So a lot of organizations are taking a look at, I know we are at the University of Texas, to make sure that we've dotted the I's, crossed the T's, we dry-runned our plans, really making sure that we understand, because if that were to go down, you know, in the case of Austin, Texas, you know, it would be a big issue because we serve a huge amount of community, especially in interest and care, serving out via our internal HIE connected to multiple organizations. So to the degree of it, I know that's an item that's going to resonate and come up over discussion, especially as things are finalized.
Yeah, planning and then liability with that planning.
Good point.
As you know, you can't do everything at one time with disaster recovery business continuity. You know, even if you had all the resources in the world, it's just really hard to do and to maintain. And so what is the liability? What's the liability with open APIs? I think it kind of goes together a little bit, because you were talking about your area, but there could be algorithms ultimately dependent upon your data after it's been normalized and brought forward on a national scale. And then if you take out chunks of that algorithm, you know, who's monitoring that? How does that that's going to potentially change the outcome of the data, potentially change the patient outcome? Because it kind of has a corollary to that FDA request for information. I'm also wondering what's the liability, or what I've come into, I had a problem with some of the newer companies is they'll run some, let me use like pharmacogenomics as an issue. There's two companies that I was looking at to integrate into our EHR so that we've got real-time point-of-care help with that. One I really like had some data but has this black box that's proprietary, and they won't let you look at it. So if my data flows in, out comes this result, and it looks really good, but it's very uncomfortable for a clinician to not be able to look at that.
Mm-hmm.
I get it. If they'd come up with this new one, I mean, that's maybe how they make their money. So is there a role, I'm just throwing this out there, is there a role for the FDA or another government agency to vet that and say, Brett, we've looked at it, it's up to snuff, you know, I don't know if that's any better, so the government says trust us, it's okay, but these are going to come fast and furious and have the potential to really change how we deliver care at the point of care to people who have no idea what an algorithm is. You know, well, that's not true. I said, hopefully most physicians know what an algorithm is. But you know what I'm saying? It's like they don't know where it comes from. They're just saying, wow, my EHR has told me there's a 99% chance that Aaron's going to have a reaction to this medicine, so I'm not going to prescribe this. I'm going to prescribe this one. Okay, that's a big deal. I don't have time nor the expertise to dig in and make sure the algorithm is upon me and my organization if we're going to put it into play to validate it. I just think it's coming to light because of all this information exchange and the ability to say, well, now we can take a social determinant of health and put this into this algorithm, and now we can give you a better patient outcome because of, okay, where is it coming from, and how do we vet that if the companies that create them, it's proprietary and we can't look at it?
You know, I don't want to dovetail because this is about sort of the macro level, but I wonder if that's a great discussion for later today around the information blocking and those components of maybe other dimensions, because I think you have to bring up a great point as to what is the liability and what is the responsibility of us as health IT leaders and clinical health IT leaders to say, hey, this is in a good public interest or not, and then a partnership with the larger government as a whole to make sure those things are vetted, because you're right, the days of, hey, just trust me, I got it, that can't fly, right? That can't fly. That's a great point.
And the regulatory environment may be right to do something about that, because so much of what you just described really dovetails with the Theranos saga.
Yeah, great point.
I was reading the book last weekend on the treadmill, and it's in lockstep, you know, the sense of the black box, you can't peek in, trust us.
Yeah.
Especially when you think about malpractice and the liability that floats down even to individual providers.
And to use that
people need some grounds on which to feel like there's some science there.
Absolutely. And, I mean, if you could fool the number of very intelligent people, if believe half of the book, it's kind of scary how quickly and how fast things could go and how far they could go.
Yep.
This at least evolved in the bad blood book process. Yeah. An algorithm is just, you know, information being sent. How quick could that happen? At least you had to say, well, you didn't draw the blood right, it was this, or you had to give blood. Now you're affecting care potentially, at, and even at population health level, with things that you're not managing and how quickly.
That's a great point. You know, one of the arms that I've gotten involved with recently is our commercialization arm and our partnership. Again, university, it's very common. And the digital therapeutic arena and those conversations about IP and understanding how those things flow have, and I'm just thinking in my head how often that's coming up recently and how much that's how important that's, that dimension is going to be to iron out and be crystal clear with people, particularly as the NPRMs are finalized and APIs truly are more commonplace and whatnot. So to the degree of it, I think that's a fabulous topic that we really should look at or consider or think about and talk about some more and understand a little bit more about. That's a great space. And where does HIPAA intersect with that, right? And these other dimensions.
What's happening is that you and I and all the organizations are having these one-off conversations every time. Event. And, you know, you can come up with your process. We can come up with our process. But then there's a little tweak to this, a little tweak to that. And it's very resource-intensive. And then you still end up, at the end of the day, not confident in what you've got, what's my liability, and if I send this information out, where's my liability stop? From a clinician's perspective, one of the things that constantly pops up, you know, when someone sitting next to me in our high-tech meeting will say, you know, don't let perfect be the enemy of good. I'm like, we're dealing with patient information, things that affect your health. I mean, we should strive. If that potassium at 4.2, it's 5.2. Like, no, that's a huge deal.
Yeah, right.
And it's not like, oh, it's close enough to the point of the Theranos where, well, let's just get 20 data points and we'll pick the middle one. Like,
That's interesting, and that's actually this topic came up on the pediatric work group that we're on, and looking about the accuracy of how technology maybe can't. There was that debate that we had a couple calls ago about, hey, maybe we can't force the vendors to do this, and I made the comment of saying, look, let's not let technology be the inhibitor here. Let's try to make it as transparent and trustworthy as possible, or at least propose how we get there. Right, if it's a series of steps, fine. But I think to the degree of it, you're right. I mean, the trust at the end of the day is the essence of our healthcare ecosystem. And if we lose that or mask that or inadvertently mistake that, that's a disaster. So I think it's a good point.
There are a lot of reasons why changing a clinician's behavior is like moving a tanker. It's not, you know, a little sport. There are more than one reason. But trust is huge.
Mm-hmm.
First, Brett, you should be doing this now. I've been doing this for 20 years. This works fine for me. So you're exactly right. If we erode trust the first couple of years that these things are out there, you're going to lose maybe a generation of clinicians that will really buy in. Now, some of that they won't have control over if it's, you know, embedded into our systems. But
yep.
It is an important non-technical thing that plays off the technical pieces.
Okay, so we've talked about the black box effect, right, and really bringing light to that. We talked about potential HIPAA considerations around that. We talked about potential intersections with the FTC, the FDA, and other agencies. We've talked about, you know, understanding from a disaster recovery, business continuity, availability of data kind of situation. We've talked about all these. I think these are phenomenal dovetail topics based upon previous year's work. Of things that are going to need to be looked at and considered and thought about. How do we do this, and is this part of our charge as a HITACH to consider, and what downstreams, right? The other thing I would think is going to be this issue that I'm even trying to tackle right now, which is globalization and data flowing overseas, and the amount of patients that we see as a major metropolitan city, and I know the country sees, and the rules governing that data, and truly the ambiguity when it comes to what happens for a European student, patient, citizen, and they're here and that they go back. Is it just GDPR? Are there other considerations? How do we make sure data flows back to where they came from and vice versa? I mean, it's a constant conversation that we're having that is only going to magnify, especially, you know, wonderful country of ours is truly the hub of so much, particularly when it comes to healthcare. So how do we make sure that there's a complete circle? Because at the end of the day, you're going to get an incomplete record otherwise. And as a clinician, you're going to be like, what, half facts and half digital? This is not good, right? So to the degree of it, there's got to be a level of either partnership, understanding, awareness, I don't know what that is, but consideration. So I know that we talked to a few folks last go-round with the ARG about what we're doing, what they were doing in Italy and other things. It would be interesting to hear more about that. It would be interesting to hear more about, you know, what are other countries doing, and are there other lessons to be learned? Are there lessons that the NHS has learned having their spine network where they're able to share that kind of data rapidly, you know? Are there things you're like, man, this was a huge bugaboo. I wish we knew this ahead of time. Great. Let's identify that and think about it, right, because we're going to suffer the same things potentially. Other comments? Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you. So we're just kind of going through topics here of items that we have heard over the past several weeks and others, and before we go open up the agenda from last time of items that we deliberately earmarked to come back to.
Do we want to run down the list here?
Yeah.
And see if there's anything that we may have.
I think that's a great idea. That's a great idea.
So you're saying be organized in our discussion?
I haven't had coffee yet, so I will attempt my best.
That makes
sense. Carolyn, do you mind starting that one? The list, well, perfect.
Yeah, so starting at the very beginning, the top of the high-tech comment, member comments, price transparency and patient access to price information.
Mm-hmm.
Patient matching, we already rehashed that. Address policy and trust issues for open APIs.
This is the one that Ken was very passionate about, if I remember right. Yep.
And I think there's probably going to be pretty fertile ground there since that's a component of NPRM.
Mm-hmm. Is it also a component of some of the charges for the U.S. CDI work group and looking at some of the components there, or no?
Christina?
I know she's mid-transit, so.
She's probably coming up the tunnel. we can check with
Christina
when we get there.
Yeah.
I couldn't get off mute. So, Aaron, repeat the question on correlating to U.S. CDI
with
the APIs.
This was the comment that during the last high-tech, Ken had really spoken very passionately about it. I think everybody agreed with him. It was just about timing at that point, where the comment was really formal guidance being provided on compliance with relevant privacy and security regulations, such as HIPAA, on the current uses of FHIR APIs, such as in Smart or FHIR applications or CDS hook services. And what he was saying was that with the advent and the adoption of APIs, you know, is there a bifurcation between what HIPAA provides and covers and what it doesn't, and how do we get that out to the developer community, and how do we better understand that, and are there other standards need to be developed to support HIPAA and make sure that it's not just you have a highway with two-lane traffic, bi-directional traffic, but you have speed limits per se. Is that, and my question was, is that part of the U.S. CDI work group to look at those considerations, or is it truly just standards-based work for U.S. CDI?
I think that's going to be more of the Interoperability Standards Priorities Task Force. Because if you think about the U.S. CDI, and don't hold me to this, but if I'm kind of just thinking out loud, U.S. CDI is more about getting that based standards that are not standards that we need, but data classes that we need. So what kind of data do we want to collect? And it's less about the transport or the how we transport the data, and more about the what data. So I'm not sure. It's something we could talk about in the expansion process, and this is kind of goes back to my original comment earlier today on how we need to look at the crossover, but I do see it definitely fitting probably in the Interoperability Standards Priorities Task Force.
Great point. Great point. Thank you. That's a great point. Okay.
Good. The next issue, patients' electronic address information. This was a comment along with the exchange of imaging reports and images. Things brought forward by Clem McDonald.
I would also add on this digitization of new types of images. And I'm going to give you an example, which is digital pathology. This year, finally, the FDA certified the very first modality to be able to digitize slides, and we're looking at it now, and only to realize that the space for standards and the space for doing that is so early days. I literally think back to when radiological images were first digitized off of the light boxes, and folks are like, how do we do this? it's the same questions all over again. I feel like I'm living in a paradox. So that there is a degree of how do we help further adoption of that, and how do we continue to help get things digitized, like Slideware, which if you think about, every day is millions of slides couriered between facilities at a tremendous cost and a tremendous lack of access to that information. So to the degree of it, I think that's a good point to think about. How do we do that? All right.
Highlight VA data quality initiatives.
Okay.
I know that we've really talked a lot about what the VA is doing, so it's probably a good time to take a look at that because they have, you know, the largest patient group pretty much around. And
yeah, I would say that, between that or the DOD, right? I know the DOD has been really putting out some good stuff recently about things they're learning and things they've realized, so maybe both.
Yep.
And particularly as they're going through their implementation over the next however long.
Right.
You learn a lot about your systems when you do that, so it may be an appropriate time to ask.
I think that's a great point.
Yep. Challenges with incorporating and reconciling data received from various external sources. That's a good tie-in to the PGHD stuff that we have looked at this year and will probably continue to look at going forward.
And maybe payment around that as well. So, I don't know if that is directly our charge or just more of a recommendation that we should help to maybe transmit back to CMS and say, can there be clarity around some of this? Because I'll give you a specific example. When looking at things like patient-reported outcomes, it's very murky to understand, are these reimbursable items, however they translate directly to decision-making and clinical decision support for admission. Case in point, if somebody is reporting that they may feel severely depressed and or have tendencies or thoughts of suicide, you know, psychiatric help can be readily available immediately before the person presents based on what they're reporting back and answering certain types of questions. However, we look at that and look at it from a CMS funding perspective. It's very unclear what mechanisms that may go. So not only with PGHD, but are there ways CMS can help the audience clarify or open up a phone a friend? Because when I was looking at this specifically, I said, who do I ask? There is no really buddy to ask. It's kind of like, well, jeepers, how do we deal with that? So.
And that ties in also to the next one, the cross-state data exchange and privacy considerations.
Mm-hmm.
You know, where is it going? What are the rules that relate to it there?
Mm-hmm.
Where is it coming from? What do we have to worry about?
Yep.
And not just the rules about, you're exactly right, but if I'm getting information that I didn't ask for with all this exchange, what's my liability in all those documents for the end user? Because that is something I hear from my colleagues all the time. Like, I got this stuff, and they have to click done. What does that mean? What is legally done? That's what the button says. Does that mean I've reviewed it? Does that mean I'm now responsible for it? I can't clear it out of my in basket unless I don't want to push that button.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
And because if there's a hidden something in those 100 pages that I just got and something happens, I'm like, you reviewed that. Why didn't you notice that? So there's that is a growing problem as we continue to. That's a little bit of what I think Stephen was talking about on that challenges of incorporating all this reconciled data too, because you're reconciling it multiple times. I got CVS data. I'm getting it also from Walgreens. Well, it's the same medication list, so I've got to go through and do it twice now. You know, those kinds of questions.
That's a great point. And also, how does that play into the recently sort of changed guidelines about residency and documentation of medical record and sign off on that, right? We're waiting for that right now, just looking at that saying, you know, because we obviously have a medical school as component, it's part of our academic medical center. And so it's to what degree the things have to be reviewed and signed off and to what specificity and what does it actually mean, you know. So each word that a resident types into the note or the chart, the attendee, should they look at every single word and say done to each word or done to a pair? I mean, it's very interesting, the considerations, to your point, that have to be there. So what is that limit so you don't go overboard?
Right.
And it ties back to the PGHD issues also.
Mm-hmm.
And as we start trying to bring PROs into clinical care, not just clinical trials, you know, providers and organizations need clarity around the liability issue. Maybe that's a conversation that we should try to get into with some experts this year, since it seems like nobody else is doing it.
I think it's
people have been asking about it for many years, you know, as we start to come along.
You're absolutely right. I mean, I queried about 24 CIOs of mine across the country saying, what are you doing with PROs? And, I mean, the answers were very interesting, and a lot of folks all had the same theme as to, we really don't know who to ask or how to bring this together and start looking at, but it's such an important element of care. And the other aspect of it, back to the topic we're speaking about, is if you provide a PRO back to a patient and you provide them their clinical summary attached to that, how do you help them interpret that?
Yeah.
You know, and today, you know, case in point, we're providing it as a discrete lab value back to the patient because we believe in full transparency to see it. And the amount of questions we get back from our patients is very interesting, you know, depending on what type of PRO and what they answered and how it's scored and the care that was given when they first presented. It's just interesting. All of that is very emerging space. And I think it's going to become even more important as we're collecting even more data, to your point.
So that gets us through topics suggested by other members
mm-hmm.
of the HITACH. Coming to the list of things that we brought forward, there were
mm-hmm.
digiceuticals.
There was digiceuticals, yes.
Oh. The word that...
No, you know, it's not, actually. It's not. It is a term that has been used in very many papers. Yeah,
you should.
Yeah, right. I would if I could go back in time, absolutely.
implications of the California Consumer Privacy Act of 2018 and the European Union's
mm-hmm.
General Data Protection Regulation and Privacy Shield. I think Washington State is also looking at doing something.
Yeah, I saw that, yep.
Right now in other states. For some reason, I'm thinking Pennsylvania, but that might not be right. But it's something that states are starting to look at more because the space is wide open and consumers are happy.
You've got vendors like
yeah.
Epic, for instance,
yeah.
creating de-identified amalgamations of data.
Yep.
You know, that's going to affect their efforts if they're like, okay, we can do it all, but from Washington, California. Or if you've got, now you've got European Epic data, now we can't. Those kinds of, again, if we don't get some federal guidance, then the states are going to, you know, over the next decade, we'll have 50 different ways of doing it, which makes data exchange clearly much harder.
You're exactly right. Again, this goes back to your earlier comment about, you know, learning what the DOD and others are learning from as they exchange data, because obviously they're nationwide. You know, what are some of the gotchas they've had to overcome? Even though they're a federal agency, maybe have other things to consider, there's still lessons learned. So I think it's a good point.
Which brings us to the 42 CFR Part 2
mm-hmm.
and FERPA.
Yes.
Sharing student records, data segmentation. We're going to be looking a little bit at data segmentation in the health IT care continuum
yep.
task force.
Yes, we are.
Maybe that'll give us a little bit of a direction in terms of...
That's a good point. Yeah, we did go into this during that and really to what degree is the intersection point there between FERPA and HIPAA and others. And then, of course, 42 CFR, and then also, you know, SAMHSA and other substance abuse type of information. I look forward to that discussion because I think this is another area where I have seen and I have heard a lot of folks in very wide ranges of the spectrum here, and I honestly think this needs to be clearer to folks.
Yeah, good point. Note bloat?
Yes. So,
hello, it's Brett.
Yeah, go for it, Brett. We had a good discussion about this last time, but go ahead.
No, it's just as more data is made available, the comfort level for the end user clinician is we'll pull it in, and then it makes things more difficult to find. You know, each vendor has certain ways around it. I'm an Epic shop, so you've got your reason for the visit, and then your encounter. And the encounter will have your vital sign, anything that was done to the patient during that visit, including the physician's note. We're not used to that. We're used to the physician's note standing alone. That's the way we were taught. Like, if it goes to court, everything that happened needs to be in your note, and that's really not the legal standard anymore. But then changing behavior, again, is very, very difficult. So if you look at the United States and the regulations that we have for coding and billing primarily in the legal atmosphere versus European, you know, Epic is that's the first time I really looked at it. Now Epic's got some European shops, and so the notes are 40% the length in Europe than they are here. And when it's been analyzed, at least at an Epic level, they're saying, you know, they've just got all these links that are just pulling in data. Okay, is there any changes to this, any changes to that? So as this data becomes more available, now these notes that we rely on, that's what we go to find what happened with Caroline last visit, what happened with Aaron last visit. I don't want to see all this stuff being brought in yet. We don't have – there's some movement, obviously, with some of the changes that started this year, But that continued education, if that's all that it takes, if there's no more federal guidance that needs to happen, we could use the federal, you know, resources for education and say, no, 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 that's fine. You don't need that in your node. You don't need that in your node. You don't need that in your node to change behavior. But it's a real problem in delivering care that interoperability potentially could make worse.
Mm-hmm. That's a good point. So after our last discussion about this, I actually went back to my organization, and we started researching a few ways to help this, because I started looking at their notes, and our notes progressively have gotten longer, more bloated, which is good and bad, right? And particularly because we also have a medical school, so when I look at certain patients, I'm like, boy, you're scrolling. So we're looking at tools like natural language processing and others to try to really upfront standardize, automate, and fill in as much of the note as possible. So that way you're coming back and you're more of just reading approve versus having to type it in, and it's streamlining what needs to be in there, right? So it's almost creating templates based upon appointment type, visit type, those considerations. It gets difficulty if you go into more of an acute care setting and more trauma-based, but if you can at least get the ambulatory setting there, you're half the way there, right? So to the degree of primary care others. So is that a consideration point? Should we look at NLP and as that ties into AI and others downstream? You know, are there technologies there? Where does that intersection point with health IT? I don't know. I'm just throwing it out there as, are these consideration points?
No, but it, I mean, you're right. It's coming. I hope sooner rather than later from just a burnout. And to be fair, it's not just federal regulations and interoperability that leads to that problem. So, but yeah, maybe worth looking at and seeing what we can identify.
Mm-hmm.
I think fixing it is probably piecemeal. It's not necessarily off.
Yeah, right.
Got the right regulations.
Right.
But it is a major problem, and if there can be, just imagine, it's comforting to a clinician. If we can improve usability of EHRs, which is part of what we're talking about here, I think traditionally some of my older colleagues will use their note as their chart. So instead of, I'm not very facile with my EHR, or it's not set up the way I like it, so I'm going to put everything about this patient in my note, so I have one point of reference to go to. I mean, that's the reality of where we are when these things were rolled out with not a lot of end-user thought to it. So we're fighting a lot of pieces with that. So I get that. Like,
yep.
I don't know where else to go, but if I go to my note, I know it's in there. Like, oh, my gosh, but you can't have this 17-page note every time, because I get them. And as primary care physician, I'm like, what happened this time? That's all I want to know. I know Aaron had strep throat in fourth grade, but what now?
Right.
That's the clinical impact that happens, because you end up missing things that are important, not to mention just the time. And
that troublesome Aaron, gee, just gives you a handful. Sorry about that. Right. Anyway. All right.
Consumer access to immunization data.
Mm-hmm. We talked about this, too, in our pediatric work group. So this is – I learned a tremendous amount in that work group about the variety within the states and the difference of the template types across state lines. And I wonder how many people actually know that. I mean, there's such good information coming out of that work group. I can't wait to be presented today, because I had no idea. And I actually started looking at this, and it's amazing just the school forms of what is needed for immunization type, and how states like New York – have a form that the vendors are saying you can't digitize this because it's all free text and it's all, you know, non-conformable shapes. It's just this weird thing that was ratified in state law, essentially. So to the degree of it, you know, are these components to bring up and tease out and say, hey, we need to consider how do we get through this? Because that's going to be a big barrier.
Have they been talking at all about some of the human resources laws that really interfere with some of this? And what I'm referencing is, for instance, in our organization, if I get a flu shot through HR,
mm-hmm.
which I'm required to do, that does not flow to my chart, because that has to be two separate charts, human resources that we can't. We talked about putting up an electronic barrier, but what we ended up doing is it's two separate databases. So what I'm trying to do, because my clinicians are coming to me and they're like, it's not just I wanted to know that Brett had his flu shot, it's also, Brett's getting these reminders that he doesn't have his flu shot from our automated systems. But I did. I had it at your place. What are you talking about? You know, so it's really frustrating. So now we're looking to go interface this product that stores our HR stuff with our state information exchange. And then once we're bidirectional with them, you know, it's silly, but it's all predicated on these HR rules that say, oh, no, your HR chart has to be different. Data segmentation, maybe it goes there. Anyway, it was not 100% this.
No, it's a good point.
Kind of a corollary to that, that, again, we've got all these rules about who can share what, and the more data that's shared, are we going to make more rules and more segmentation? Because I think that's going to end up making it worse. We've talked about this before, Aaron, where psychiatric and substance abuse records have to be kept separate. Why? From a clinician's perspective, I need to see everything about you to make the best, wisest recommendations or decisions. I don't know. I understand socially why that is, but we've got laws that protect that data through HIPAA. I'm still liable to not letting that out, so I don't understand why we need all these separate rules for a student or if HR.
And consent and everything else, right. So that's a good point. Carolyn, Christina, I know you're in the car. Just curious, any thoughts there?
Are you on mute?
I think this is I'm coming off. I think this is a great topic. I am fully supporting of it, and I think it's really important for patients too. I think about just access to immunization records as a mom, and it's like the one thing I want easily every time I need school forms or camp forms, and it's a hassle right now to get them.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think of like one of my best friends actually recently told me that she wanted this problem solved. She's getting ready to go to Peru and has lived in multiple states, and she's going for a two-year teaching, teach abroad thing. And it's been a nightmare trying to figure out where her immunization records are, what she has, what she doesn't have, and just being able to get them from the different states and then figuring out, like, what exists where. Took her a lot more time than she realized, and she's like, why isn't this easy? So I think that from a consumer access and patient perspective, it's something that we should just really address, and I think there's a need.
Got it. Okay.
And I think there's also a related issue in that we will, if we haven't already, we will soon be identifying the public health need in terms of getting a better understanding of where unvaccinated people are and where those concentrations occur so we can start planning for epidemics and outbreaks. I know last night in the New York Times there was an article about an outbreak of measles in Brooklyn, and certainly that's something we've been seeing in Oregon and Vancouver, right there on the Oregon-Washington state line. Even if we had laws that required parents to vaccinate tomorrow, we still have an unknown population of children who haven't been for many years who will be susceptible, and that will have consequences potentially for the next 10 to 20 years. So it would be good to start getting a handle on where the populations are and to be able to do predictive analytics and some planning around it.
Does the CDC already do anything like that?
Yeah.
I'm asking, I'm assuming that, like, KHI, our state exchange, has to report that state, that data to the CDC.
Good question. I don't know.
I don't know.
So again, it's back to the point of
Brett, I couldn't hear you. What was the question?
I was just asking if the CDC was already doing some of that, and if they were, my thought was, can we leverage that to help your friend's issue? I don't mean specifically, but that where you're trying to find, okay, but if the CDC is tracking this, I've got to believe that they're not just flying by the seat of their pants when we have these outbreaks. They have some idea where immunization rates have dropped. I've seen maps like that from them.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe not to a community level, I don't know. But if they've got that, how are they accessing that data, and then can that be merged somehow when a patient needs to go, listen, I don't care where I got it done in the country. If it's recorded at the CDC, can I access that? I don't know. I'm just...
Yeah, good question. I don't know. Maybe they're extrapolating something else.
Yeah,
I don't know. Great question. Okay.
Public comment?
Yep.
Yeah, why don't we do that, operator? Doesn't look like we have many public participants. Can you open the public line?
Yes, thank you. If you'd like to make a public comment, please press *1 on your telephone keypad, and a confirmation tone will indicate your line is in the queue. You may press *2 if you'd like to remove your comment from the queue. For participants using speaker equipment, it may be necessary to pick up your handset before pressing the star keys.
And do we have anyone in the queue?
Not at this time.
They're all getting coffee.
Okay, so maybe I know we still have, you know, just half to go. Should we just maybe wrap up with PDMP and then we can revisit the at a later date?
That's a perfect idea.
PDMP integration with EHRs.
Mm-hmm.
Aaron?
Yep. And so to the degree of it, there is this is a I think a known not only is it problematic and it's a burden for physicians to have to go and check multiple sources that is not natively integrated into the EMR. It's also a state issue as varying states mandate this and whatnot. It's very varied. And to the degree of it, like right now in Texas, case in point, the Texas Senate just passed last night a bill that will finally mandate this within Texas, and so hopefully the House signs off and at least Texas gets on board with this. That's great for me, but what about the rest of the country, to your point, that chart that was sent out? I know that in the last meeting, I think this was the topic that Dr. Rucker spoke up and said that there's a lot of work going on out there to the point of that chart and others, and this is a very tricky and nuanced situation. So,
ONC and CDC are working together on a project like that that we happen to be involved in as an organization. So I don't know if there's other things that they're doing too, but it's just from a practical perspective, it's going to move slow.
It is.
It's difficult.
But maybe maybe there's ways to take some of that work and sum it up and put it into the report and even recommendations to help those efforts, right? And say, hey, how can we bring some of this together and just help bring light to and maybe just bring a conversation to the powers that be and say, we could use help with X, Y, and Z, right, as we do standards and all this other work that's going on. And also it's a way to give credit and highlight to some of the task force that are going on that I wasn't aware of, like that chart.
I think you make a good point. And, you know, the federal government, even though there are 50 different state regulations on this, if the federal government said it's okay to store a patient's PDMP record in the legal medical record, or it's not one way or the other, now you can still have your state regulation, but at least it would give cover if someone wanted to change it or felt as an organization, well, I've got the federal, I mean, it's a little bit like, you know, marijuana legislation, you know, no one, you know, you can get the federal level and then the state level, I guess it'd be reversed, but anyway.
You can give guidance at least to it, right? Can I leave it, but at least, that's a great point. That's a great point. Okay. All right, so I guess we'll pick up the rest of the topics on the next call and give us more chance to go back and marinate and finish up some of these task forces that we're currently on.
Great.
And see what comes out of them.
Great.
Any comments round table before we get
I'll just check in. Michelle, anything else that you wanted to cover that we missed before we wrap up?
No, I was just wondering, you could group the last three together pretty quickly, and then we have cleaned up that one section. Something else is something.
Oh, the recordings and the photographs?
Yeah. You could kind of sum up that.
Yep. So these three ones I brought up, just to really sort of expand the modality types. We did talk about natural language processing last time. Good. And so to the degree of it, how do we make sure that it's not just data, but it's data types, again, recordings, video, photographs, sort of that discussion I meant earlier about how do we, not only do we take things like slides and digitize them and transmit them and share them, but also how do we expand the electronic medical record so it's not just discrete data, it's everything necessary for you as a clinician, Brett, to make a recommendation.
I think they're all kind of lumped together. I mean, I'm sure technically they're not close to being lumped together, but
well, and there's nuances too, right, to each of those, right? So maybe types of consent that's needed for audio, because I can think of privacy laws that specifically call out audio and recording within different states and needing one party authorization. I think with videos, something similar, and it's very nuanced, and then photographs are very nuanced as well. So it gets into a whole slew of privacy and other components. But maybe there's a way, I like your idea, is there a way at a higher level we can make a recommendation so we can advance it versus folks going, oh, it's too difficult, we can't solve this. Well, we could do this instead, right? So, okay. All right, so we will pick up the other items. There's a few left on here. Next report work group, and then gives us time to go back again and marinate on any other topics. And then, Michelle, anything else for us?
No, this is very helpful. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Should we do a brief verbal poll about what our schedules are like in early June, just so we can start thinking about when we might want to schedule the next call? I know we all want to get past the NPRM stuff, and probably past the holiday at least before we pick up.
I would say so. That would be helpful for me. That would be helpful.
You don't have time for more meetings, Eric?
I mean, you know.
Gee, dedication.
Yeah.
You can also send like a doodle poll or something.
Yeah, that would be helpful. Yeah, there we go.
Yeah.
Okay. We'll get a doodle poll out and get some things in the books in ASAP.
Awesome.
Beautiful. Thank you all. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Care,
thank you.
You know.